call the meeting to order of the Southern Nevada Health District Facility Advisory Board meeting, April 23rd. Item number two is public comment. Is there any public comment? Oh, I'm sorry, yeah, let's do a roll call to make sure we have a quorum.
Yeah, this is Todd Sternberg on the phone, having a very difficult time hearing.
Okay, Todd, can you hear us now? We're going to do a roll call.
Okay, that's better, thank you.
Okay, thank you, we'll make sure we speak in the mics here.
Okay, thank you, do we have anyone from Boulder City Hospital? Dignity Health, I have Laura Haney present, do I have anyone else from the Dignity Health System? We'll start over, is there Boulder City? Dignity Health, I have Laura Haney present, is there anyone else from Dignity Health? HCA, do I have anyone present from HCA? I have Todd Sternberg.
This is Dave Morgan representing Southern Hills.
Dave Morgan with Southern Hills, is there anyone else?
Jeremy Bradshaw with Mountain View.
Thank you. Do you have anyone from Michael Callahan Federal Hospital?
This is Wade here.
Thank you. Monta Vista, I have present. Is there anyone from North Vista?
This is Marsha. Vince will be here, he's at another meeting, but he's on his way.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
We have Dr. Dallison here from Ross and Neal, thank you. UHS Valley Health Systems, I have Robert Fremiello present, and I have Leonard Trioff present. Do I have anyone else from the UHS Valley Health Systems?
Ryan Jensen.
Sam Coffey from Henderson Hospital.
Colin Wise from Valley Hospital.
Josh Clark from Centennial.
Thank you. I have UMC present. Do you have anyone with the VA?
This is Tracy Scala. I'm here.
Thank you. Is there anyone from West Care? Thank you. We have quorum.
Okay. Thanks, Ms. Maddox, for doing the roll call. Moving on to item number two is public comment. Is there anyone from the public that would like to speak on any agenda items appearing today? Seeing none and hearing none, we'll move on to agenda item number three, which is adoption of the agenda for April 23rd, 2019. Hopefully everyone's had a chance to review the agenda. I think we've got a good one for you today and good education. Can I get a motion to approve the agenda?
So moved.
So moved.
Okay. Can I get a second, please?
Second. I heard, because I think I heard someone on the phone.
Who made the motion on the phone, please? Todd?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Todd, we've got you noted. And
second.
Okay. Thank you. Item number four is the consent agenda, and on our consent is our meeting minutes from the January 22nd meeting of 2019. Hopefully everyone's had an opportunity to review those minutes, and if there's any changes or updates, please let us know, but I'd like to take a motion to approve the consent agenda.
So moved.
Thank you, Mr. Freehoff. Second, please. We'll give it to Dave Morgan from Southern Hills. Okay, thank you. Item number five, so we're going to go to our reports, discussion, and actions. And under item number five, number one is receive and discuss an update on emergency room internal disaster declarations from Mr. John Hammond for possible action and review. And this particular agenda item was as a result of our last meeting under emerging issues, where there was some discussion related to internal disaster and capacity hours at facilities. So Mr. Hammond is going to do a PowerPoint for us in looking at 2017 versus 2018 and first quarter 2019. So Mr. Hammond, I'll turn it over to you, and if you can speak right into the microphone so our room participants can hear us.
Good afternoon, everybody. I just ran a few quick reports from EM System to take a look at interim disaster declarations through those years that were indicated. Take a look at 2017, your total hours on internal disaster of 2910. That's for all facilities. And the largest contributor to those hours was in, capacity issues, as noted in the excuse field, or the reason field, I should say. I'm going to go through these rather quickly, and we'll have a discussion at the end. This is just the raw data that I ran. As you can see in the graph there, the other issues that came up and the hours that they were on disaster for those particular ones, you know, communications issues, computer diagnostic, mass casualty, not our security concern. None is a little concerning because I don't know what happened in those, but that is getting better. This is in 2017, so that's getting better. Here's the quarter of 2017 broken down at the capacity level. So as you can see, quarter one of 2017, which was a horrific flu season, if you all remember, quite a few hours being shut down, probably secondary to that. And then it goes a little bit further down and then back up during quarter four when flu season rears its ugly head again. In 2018, about 1,000 or 1,500 less hours, 1,409 total, and again, the largest contributor being capacity. As you can see, the other ones are pretty small as well. Security concerns, storm damage, flooding, utilities, diagnostic, or the computer was down. 2018 by quarter, again, you can see the flu season kind of rearing its ugly head in the first quarter and all the way down. Quarter four was pretty nice, actually. In the first quarter of 2019, this is where we're sitting at today, most of the hours again being in capacity issues and very few in a security concern. And this is a quarter over quarter from 2017 to 2019 displayed here, and just using the capacity issues since that was the largest contributor to those hours. Didn't take a trend line to show that it's going down, but let me put it in there anyway because I'm a completist. So what can we be inferred by this data? We see that the internal disaster kind of correlates with the severity of influenza-like illnesses as they move through the flu season. And that very few of the hours on internal disaster are actually caused by issues other than capacity, those being plant failure, fire, flood, sewer issues, or computer failure. I did not put in there the security issues, and that seems to be one that's coming up a little bit more. Discussions have been ongoing over the capacity issue as a trigger for internal disaster. It's been going on through the Medical Advisory Board and the Drug Device Protocol Committee, and through conversations with myself, Dr. Christian Young, our operational medical director, and Rodney Wright, who manages the site at the state, manages the EMS at the state. Some concerns have been coming up lately as well during MAB open meeting or open comment times when Dr. Slaughter's come in and expressed a concern about removing some of the, he calls it diversion, it's still internal disaster, but removing some of those designations and going to a more level loading type system, allowing the crews to make those decisions based on capacity issues. Now, in our discussions with Rodney, with Dr. Young and myself, we kind of laid out a template to move forward. Agencies during the Medical Advisory Board have said that since the capacity triggers internal disaster, it has become something that occurs frequently enough that it doesn't apply the same kind of respect, if you will, with the crew, saying that it's just capacity, I'm just going to go there. And if they happen to show up when they think it's just capacity, it happens to be a police lockdown, then that's an issue. So what we have discussed is to remove capacity from one of the triggers for internal disaster, have it as a separate condition that does not trigger internal disaster, and allow those other ones that still would actually shut down your hospitals, the fire, flood, famine, sewer, plant issues, or security issues. That way the crews will know that hospital is indeed closed and indeed cannot receive patients from EMS. It will also allow them to realize that capacity issues do not close a hospital in this particular case, but they should take that into consideration when acting as best advocate for their patients and saying, you know what, hospital A is super duper busy, hospital B is close by, let's go there and get you seen a little bit quicker, and allow them to make that decision. And it may assist in spreading the wealth around the system a little bit. But that's as far as we have gotten, where it's honestly almost ready to be turned on. It's just a decision has to be made with that regard. and that's still going to be discussed during NIB, and make sure everybody's still on the same page there as well. But I think that is it for my slide. Yes, that's it for my slides. Are there any questions? I know I went fairly quickly, and I tend to do that sometimes, but I hope I expressed everything that you were concerned with in regard to internal disaster.
Thank you, Mr. Hammond, and for the kind of look back and current state, and clearly we're seeing an improvement year over year. I'm sure there are going to be some questions related to that, and certainly the flu season has an impact related to the compression and the capacity. I think some of the discussions that you're having at some of the other committees related to the use of the term internal disaster, if that's the right term, but also having EMS crews make the determination if a hospital is busier than the other, it certainly doesn't close down a hospital. I don't want the public to think that because a hospital is on internal disaster that the hospital is not operating or we're not seeing patients walking in, but it's just really a notification for crews that it may be a longer offload time or that there may be more hold times down in the ED until admission. But I'm going to open it up to the group for discussion. Anybody in the audience or in the room want to talk about the analysis and or the direction or have advice, guidance, or on the phone for Mr. Hammond?
I have a question. This is Leonard Freyhoff from Spring Valley. I seem to recall built into the criteria for internal disaster that there were some certain areas that were defined, and if one hospital was at capacity, that was understood. But if there were three hospitals in a certain geographic area, then if two or more were on had capacity issues, then it didn't apply to any. Has any consideration been given to that, or is that being enforced or followed?
It is being followed.
It seems like that would still accomplish the same goals that you had indicated, because I think if you have a kind of a geographic area and a hospital truly does have capacity issues, it may not be the most safe or prudent thing to do to transfer a patient there when there's another hospital nearby that can accommodate them, but the same applies if they're all of them have an issue from a capacity standpoint, then that's a different story.
Right. We're not thinking about removing capacity as anything other than a trigger for internal disaster. It'll still be indicated in some manner within the system itself, so they'll be able to see that it'd be a capacity. Now, that regionalized system that we developed a few years ago is still in practice today. It's fully automated, so it just happens in the background. I did have some issue trying to run a report to see how many times that turned on.
It was
kind of hard to nail that down. I'm still working on the query itself, so I get reliable data out of it. Because the report module counts time, and when something turning on and off does not take time. So I'm having a little hard time trying to see and whether or not it's being forced opened, or someone is going back to being closed automatically. It's a little difficult for me to determine at this time. But, you know, when I was looking at the data, there were very few instances where it said forced open in my report. I mean, it counts it as zero, but it's very few instances where that occurred. So that system does work, but to use it as an internal disaster, it goes back to whether or not that crew can actually physically go to that hospital or not, based on the safety issues, should that hospital be under some sort of real threat or an actual disaster.
Mr. Hammond, in your analysis, I know pediatric volume right now is very, very high, and the ERs are kind of getting swamped with pediatric cases. Is this all in adult and peds in the number?
They are. Okay. They are. And only recently, I think it's in mid-2018, we segregated out the trauma centers as well.
Okay.
So they can use the trauma bypass. Before, it was still folded in. Siena, Sunrise, and UMC were folded into
the
disaster.
Okay.
So, Mr. Hammond, this is Ed Potts-Webber from Sunrise. Sorry, I cannot be very specific. Thank you for the thorough analysis and data. Just as a follow-up to Leonard's question, do we have the data that you could aggregate by each of the four quadrants just to give us a sense of internal disaster by quadrant and then within that quadrant by facility?
Yes, I could. I would just have to run the same report I did and just segregate out those hospitals by region, so it's not a problem.
I guess, Todd, you know, that would be a good question. Are the regions still relevant? And I know we've added more beds, more hospitals to the community, neighborhood hospitals as well. So I think that would be interesting to see the results related by region and if it's spread out equally in those areas or not. So, Todd, any other questions?
No,
not
from here.
Okay, very good. Laura Henham?
So another question for Mr. Hammond. So in thinking through, just thinking about the mention of neighborhood hospitals, satellite ERs, I know that there's a move to potentially revisit the protocol for incoming EMS, incoming ambulances for those remote outpatient ER in the case of neighborhood hospitals, micro hospitals. So my question is, might there be, because there may be some relation between the impact, or right now there's so many ERs, facilities impacted, that as the various bodies take a look at that, revisiting that protocol, would it make sense to look at these two in conjunction? Because I know that originally when that protocol was put together, obviously a very different landscape relative to the facilities that were taking emergency patients, and with the micro hospitals, obviously the inpatient component as well. So I just didn't know if there might be a thought kind of putting these two or creating some proximity between this report and the revisiting of the protocol, since that may help with the change protocol, having additional patients being able to access through incoming EMS to those remote locations and helping decompress some of the impact on those other facilities that end up having to go on divert.
We can certainly use this report in conjunction with the study that we're putting together now. I haven't got all my data set together yet for that, and that's going to be gone through during our QA committee meeting as we take a look at the utilization of those off-site EDs, and we can certainly fold in the internal disaster component with that. We just have to figure out a way to do that.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Okay. I have a question. You might have seen me smile during his presentation, but I thought I heard you say something about famine being a cause for...
Could have been. It tends to happen when there's a fire, flood, famine.
I don't think that was serious. And, you know, I've been around here for a number of years now, and many of you recall those conference calls we used to have probably 3 years ago, 4 years ago maybe, in terms of trying to encourage you all to reopen, and we haven't had any of those calls since that one season, and I think partly it's due to the decrease in influenza cases, and partly it's due, I think, to this regionalization being workable. The other thing is that we need to remember, and we will always do this, but we need your help in encouraging people to get their influenza shot. Because that's going to be one of the things to decrease that load during the influenza season.
Very true, Dr. Iser. And so thank you, Mr. Hammond, for this. You know, looking at the individual hospitals, there's been a lot of nice decreases year over year. So we'll just continue to press on that to make sure that we minimize that number. And I suggest, and we'll put this on as an annual item so we can review probably around this time as we come off the busy seasons, the first quarter of the year. So thank you for your report. And are there any other questions related to this topic before we move on? Would you like to see your individual numbers, or a lot of you can pull your own data out of the system, but if there's any requests to see your own data, we can provide that as well. If you want to shoot me a note offline, we can provide the report that was the query for
provided.
So yeah, so you can see your year-over-year improvements and then track it from there. So. Okay, thank you, Mr. Hammond. No action there. We're going to move on to item number 2 on the reports. Receive and discuss a legislative update for Dr. Iser. And we're more than 2/3 way through from this session, but I know you've been busy up in Carson. So if you could provide an update.
We've been busy, and
many of you know that we use Argentum, since we can't be up there, to help to represent us. And in fact, right now, I think it's today or this week, they're representing us on a bill that would allow children in schools to take sunscreen and hats to school. It just seems like a no-brainer to me, but that's something that we have been working on and are supportive of. We had a long conference call today. We've had many sort of urgent conference calls about raw milk. If you haven't heard about that, any of you who would like to express your opinions about the unsafety, the lack of safety in raw milk, we would appreciate it. We did have a conversation today about what would make public health feel comfortable in terms of going forward and being able to support raw milk. And to a person, we all said, there's nothing that can make raw milk safe. Also today, it's been in my queue for several, for maybe a week or two, but if you go to the CDC website and look under raw milk, there are three testimonials, one from my, and you'll hear my accent, one from my home state of Missouri, one from California, and I think the third one from Connecticut, related to goat and cow's milk, raw milk. And these were all E. coli cases, which resulted in significant morbidity. I don't believe anyone died from these, but as a reminder, we did have a couple of deaths right as I got here from Mycobacterium bovis, from a young mother who was eventually transferred to Southern California where the diagnosis was made. So we've tried to emphasize these risks. It's not just those two diseases, it's many diseases, brucellosis and others, that are concerning. We had a fairly robust call with Megan Conlossi, who is the LGB, is that the right term, the legislative analyst for them. And I don't think we're going to be able to stop it in the Senate. I think it was going to the floor today, but maybe we can work to try to stop it either in the Assembly or at the governor's desk, which is what happened, I think, two sessions ago when Sandoval, Governor Sandoval vetoed it. The original bill that would establish the Public Health Improvement Fund that we've talked about here a couple of times has died, but there are still, I think, two bills going forward. One that would tax e-cigarettes at the same rate as combustible tobacco products, which I hope you all would, for no other reason. It may not fund a Public Health Improvement Fund, may not fund us at all, but the public reason to do it is to prevent kids from being able to afford vaping products. And the tobacco and the marijuana and the formaldehyde and the heavy metals that are included there. That's a bill by Senator Julie Ratty, who was on the Board of Health when I was up in Washoe County and is now a senator. She just has been elevated because of some recent resignations, I think, in the Senate. And that may be a starting point for the Public Health Improvement Fund, but at least the public policy piece of getting kids to not take it up is, I think, a good one. There are several Medicaid bills that we've been trying to be supportive of, and that not only benefits you, it benefits us. If Medicaid rates can rise a little bit, then we benefit, you benefit as well for your Medicaid patients, and we'll continue to work on those. There is a bill that we've worked on with the Division of Public and Behavioral Health on chronic disease markers. I'm sure you're aware of this. It would require laboratories to report to public health entities certain markers related to chronic diseases. That would be like hemoglobin A1C to monitor for diabetes and the proper treatment of that. Some other things related to cholesterol, for example, and other markers that the division, state division, would come up with. The most recent one I saw exempted hospitals. I would hope that the urban hospitals would be willing to participate with us on this. This gives us a different baseline instead of just BMI to look at chronic diseases and how we're doing in our state with our interventions. But I'm not sure how that's going to end up. But the Hospital Association, might have been the Rural Hospital Association, came out against at least the rural hospitals having to participate. I'm going through these relatively quickly, so if you want to talk about any of them, let me know. This might be one you might be interested in. There is a bill to remove from our authority the designation for level 3 trauma centers. Some of you, I'm pretty sure, I'm not looking around at the hospitals that you're from, are applicants. I know you already, I'll look at you because you're already our level 1 trauma center. And so the idea would be to take the authority away from us, give it to the state to determine where and when new trauma centers would be authorized, and then they would come back to us to determine that. I think, and I can speak for Dr. Fields, I believe that he, Dr. Dort, and several others are national class experts on trauma and trauma care, and I believe that having this authority rest with us is the proper place for it to be. I wasn't here, but there's the story that political pressure was put on the legislature many years ago for another trauma center, and so the excuse that is being used now is that the board, my board, may be under too much political pressure, so they're going to give it back to the state. Well, there's going to be political pressure wherever there is. My argument is that if John is still here, we have nonpartisan staff who works with a wide variety of insurers and your representatives on the RTAB to develop the tool that would be used to assess whether and when new trauma centers would be developed. And I think that we're in a better position to do that than the state. Some of you may disagree with that. I know some hospitals, I think one of the Dignity hospitals originally came out against it and then is now neutral. I'm not trying to put you on the spot. I just don't remember now, but I think most of the hospitals are neutral. And I believe that this is being promoted and encouraged by the payers in general. So this will be my other argument, is that if there's someone coming in from Creech Air Force Base or from Mount Charleston and it's a trauma patient, is it better to be more local than not if there's a need for one up in that northwest segment? We haven't made that determination yet. And if they need a trauma center, is it going to cost the insurers more or less to come all the way down? In this case, it'd be the UMC, because you'd be the next closest one, than to be up in that northwest or northeast or southwest segment. And I would argue that costs being equal, the insurer is going to pay the same amount no matter where they go. So I think arguing against additional trauma centers would not be in our best interest. And I know you've heard me say that all I care about is what is the need and who can fulfill that need. That's all I care about, is the health and safety. And Mr. Hammond and Dr. Johnson, and I think all of you, what is the best way to take care of need if it's there? That's all I care about. So that would likely, I think it's probably left, I think it's already passed one house. I think you mentioned that yesterday to us. That's our, I'm sorry? It passed the Assembly and is going to the Senate. And I think that's the last thing I had, unless Dr. Johnson, you had something else? I think that that's primarily the things we have. I think the big things were the EMS and trauma systems piece and the Medicaid piece are probably where we overlap with you the most among those various things. Thank you.
Any questions for Dr. Eiser related to the discussion item? Hearing none, thank you, Dr. Eiser. And just the last bill, obviously we're tracking that as well, and decisions are best made local. Just kind of leave it at that, and I know we have the expertise and the knowledge in Southern Nevada to make those decisions, so I think many of us agree on that, so we'll be tracking that very closely as well. And it's about growing trauma centers at the right time and the right place, and I think that's ultimately what we want. And again, we have great great committees that have been working on this for years and years. So adding another layer of authority or approvals would just undermine that. So thank you for your comments.
Yeah, and I think if you look at it, so if we look at layers of approval, it would be the state, Southern Nevada, the state, and then the ACS. So it adds another whole level onto many levels of approval that are required now.
Thank you, sir. Okay, that was informational, so we're now going to move on to agenda item number 3, receive and discuss a report on the residency program from Dr. Loaf, and I think you've got some exciting news for the Southern Nevada Health District. Dr. Loaf, welcome, and if you wouldn't mind, right in the microphone for those folks on the phone.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's exciting.
So this is his first time. We always start out by saying our name and our title.
Oh, yes, yes. Please introduce yourself.
Hi. My name is Dr. Court Loaf. Cortland is my official name. I'm the residency program director at the Southern Nevada Health District, and thank you for the opportunity to allow me to present the preview on the new residency program. So one of the challenges when I talk about the preventive medicine residency program is to try to educate folks about what preventive medicine is and what that specialty is, because most folks know about the traditional residency programs that are more hospital clinical-based residency programs that train physicians to go out to the community and practice patient care. Preventive medicine residency is a unique medical specialty that's actually recognized by the American Board of Preventive Medicine. So it is legitimate. It employs what we call a population-level approach to healthcare delivery, and physicians are uniquely trained in both clinical and population-based medicine. And when they do their duties, they rely on their medical training and clinical judgment to make medical decisions for the populations they serve. Residents, folks who wish to get board certified in preventive medicine, and just to add that both myself and Dr. Iser are specialized in preventive medicine, specifically a subspecialty called public health and general preventive medicine, as is Dr. Levan, who runs our clinical services here. In order to residents to get specialized in this field, they must undergo residency training. Some of the distinctions between traditional clinical-based residency and preventive medicine residency is that the training is typically a 2-year program versus a 3-year program, although in order to enter the residency program, physicians would have had to complete a prior clinical year, such as internal medicine, family practice, or a transitional year internship. So they do have at least a full year of clinical training before they enter the residency. Some of the key components of the training include the fact that residents complete an MPH with core courses in epidemiology, biostatistics, health policy, health administration, statistics, and so on, health behavior. In addition to completing an MPH degree, they also provide direct patient care. The requirement currently is that they must provide 2 months of direct patient care during each of their 2 years. And that was a recent change because the specialty and the folks that are, the specialty began to recognize that a lot of physicians, or some physicians, complete training in preventive medicine, continue to practice direct patient care, and there's also recognition that it's good to have that clinical training as a backdrop to the work that you do in public health and preventive medicine. So, for example, when I did my training 20 years ago, I was able to complete one year without doing any additional clinical training beyond that first year, but that, of course, has changed since then. A third part of the training is they participate in practicum rotations, and what I mean by that is they basically rotate through programs and services at public health departments or other organizations that provide, again, population-level health care, just to learn about what those organizations do and try to learn those skills with the idea that once they get out of practice or training, they'll be able to apply those skills as well. And then they participate in other learning opportunities. One of the big hallmarks of residency training is to conduct research and publications. I'm sorry, Wright Publications. Upon completion of training, residents or physicians, I should say, can work in a variety of settings, including public health departments. Again, both myself, Dr. O'Gan, and Dr. Iser work in public health departments. And they can serve in a variety of roles and capacities, including as leaders, teachers, researchers, or medical directors of programs and services. And then one of the biggest differences, again, between residency training in preventive medicine versus traditional clinical residency, of course, is that those who work in the specialty typically spend little or no time providing direct patient care. Again, although some do, the emphasis, again, is on more population-based medicine and health versus on providing direct patient care. And this is one of the biggest challenges we have in explaining the specialty to a lot of folks, is that the way you're training physicians in a specialty, and yet they're not entering direct patient care when they leave. So that's a little bit of a hard thing for some folks to understand and digest, but nonetheless, the training that they undergo is really important in order for them to serve these roles in public health departments and to provide population-level health care. So a couple of years ago, Dr. Iser had this vision to develop a preventive medicine residency training program here at the Health District, with the goal of increasing the number of physicians in both Clark County and in Nevada who are certified in preventive medicine. And by doing that, we can increase the capacity to develop, implement, and evaluate programs aimed at preventing disease, as well as increasing our capacity, again, both within Southern Nevada as well as in the state, to provide leadership and support to other public health programs. So we feel that there's a dire need to fill roles in state, local public health, as well as in other roles that really focus on population medicine, both here in Southern Nevada and across the state, especially in reference to the issues that we just talked about. How do we get more people vaccinated against influenza? How do we deal with issues such as raw milk, et cetera, et cetera? So folks who are trained in this specialty really have that unique capacity, both from the public health perspective as well as the clinical training, really provide that appropriate amount of leadership and guidance when it comes to some of these population level issues. So the structure that we envision here at Southern Nevada Health District regarding our residency training program is that the institution, the health district, will sponsor the program. In fact, we received accreditation as a sponsoring institution effective July 1st, 2018. In terms of the program itself, we are capable of providing all clinical and non-clinical rotations, with the exception of the MPH, which will be obtained with our partner at UNLV School Public Health. So I wanted to emphasize that we do have both the clinical and non-clinical capacity to provide the full gamut of training here at the health district. And that's important I'm going to bring that issue back in a couple slides to emphasize a related point. And then all faculties or preceptors will be staff here at the health district, or as well as some contractors who work in our clinical side. An update on the accreditation. We submitted our application to ACGME back in March. A site visit is scheduled for tomorrow, actually. And the application will be considered at a meeting on June 14th of ACGME, at which time a decision about our accreditation will be made. The earliest the program could start would be July 1st, and we're fortunate to have a physician in the community who's an internist, who's also certified in addiction medicine and has his MPH, who's interested in joining the program as early as July 1st should we get accredited. So we're in anticipation of that, we're working diligently to try and make sure that if we are accredited, that we can start this person as early as July 1st. Funding. So we're currently receiving a grant from the state through graduate medical education grant program they have. That's a two-year grant that ends in 2020. That's been primarily used to support the development of the program, and there are funds set aside to support this one resident's his salary fringe for this first year. And we now submitted an application yesterday, in fact, for a new a second six round of funding, if you will, from that same grant program, and hope to hear by mid-May whether or not we're going to be able to get funding from that. If we're successful, we should have funding available to support most of the program operations through June of 2021. And of course, we're always looking for other funding opportunities. Unlike traditional clinical residency programs that are funded primarily by Medicare, because this is not a hospital-based residency program, we can't rely, or nor does Medicare provide training. Fortunately, HRSA does have a special carve-out in their appropriations to provide funding to preventive medicine programs. And when that cycle opens up again for new grantees, we'll be applying for that as well. And then my last slide, I wanted to talk a little bit about sustainability partnerships, because this is directly relevant to you folks. We are looking to identify and partner with others who serve as host sites for both the clinical side of things as well as for the non-clinical side of things. So we feel that there's some added value to our residents for doing rotations off-site, again, both on the clinical side and non-clinical side, and that there's a potential in doing so there's potential additional funding opportunities. So, for example, if we're able to identify some project at various institutions, and those institutions will be willing to host our residents, perhaps there might be some funding that can go along with that to help support the residency program. And I've got a growing list of potential partners, including some hospitals and other organizations that have expressed interest in partnering with us, and I just need to continue to work with them to explore those opportunities and work out the details. So if you or your institution have any interest in potentially partnering with us, again, either by providing a clinical, but more importantly, I would say a non-clinical rotation, for example, evaluating some programs or services that you have, trying to do some preventive medicine focused project, if you will, we'd certainly be interested in working with you, partnering with you to develop that project and have our residents do a rotation through your organization. So that's it. Any questions at this point?
I do have a couple of questions, Dr. Loeb. So is this the first in the state?
It is.
So
yes.
No other county has anything like this. So congratulations.
Residency program.
Big undertaking, and good luck on the visit tomorrow.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, and then how many residents per year?
So we're asking ACG&E to have 2 residents per year. So if we have a full complement, it would be a total of 4 residents. Okay. That are in training one time.
Very good. Any questions for Dr. Loaf at all related to the residency?
So you haven't seen me much up here, but I tend to add things.
Okay.
The American College of Preventive Medicine basically has 3 residency programs. This is one of them. Another one is occupational medicine. And the third one, O'Callaghan should know about, it's aerospace medicine. And they're basically the same kind of a format. You do an internship, just as Dr. Loaf mentioned. You do an MPH year, and then you do a I'll call it a clinical year, but it's a rotational year for aerospace medicine. It's on aerospace issues. For occupational medicine, it might be with big manufacturers or other kinds of places. General preventive medicine, public health, excuse me, is generally doing what we're doing here. And I think that I can foresee that some of the bigger hospital systems could probably use a GPM. One of the things that Dr. Loaf and I have talked to Dr. Komanduri about at the VA is he would like to sponsor a resident for 1 or 2 months to come out there and do QA, QI, and that may be something that you might be interested in as well. So I think there are a variety of options. If a resident wants to stay here, we don't have other options, we can host every single one of those months right here with, as Dr. Loaf pointed out, epidemiology, surveillance, environmental health, public health lab, and so on.
Good. Thank you, Dr. Loaf. Appreciate it. And anybody that wants more information, please reach out to Dr. Loaf.
Thank you. I'd be happy to leave my cards, or perhaps in the notes that we send around, I can
I'll have Edie send that out to everyone.
Okay.
Contact. Thank you, sir.
Thank you all.
Okay, item number four, receive and discuss a report on climate change and health systems from Dr. Lavoie, and I don't think this is going to be about the 95-degree weather we're going to have for the rest of the week.
Possibly related. Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Issa, for inviting me and for your time here today. My name's Joanne Leovi. I'm a family doctor with the FQHC Nevada Health Centers, and I'm really pleased to be involved for the past 2 years with the family medicine residency based out of Southern Hills Hospital, in addition to some of my other hats. But I'm here today as a volunteer for Citizens Climate Lobby. I have been in Southern Nevada for 18 years. I love the quality of life. I love the outdoor opportunities. I'm often up on top of a mountain or a bicycle or a river, and that has led me to have concern for the effects of climate change on population health and on our quality of life here. This was brought home to me last fall when I volunteered as part of the National Disaster Medical System in response to Hurricane Michael in the Florida Panhandle. We went to Panama City, where the local hospital was really quite devastated by the hurricane. The town was devastated. Many buildings were flattened. And they were running a partial ER and trying to cope with the aftermath in this large community. So we set up our base of operations in the hospital parking lot, and we ran for 3 weeks an ER offloading operation using taking the low and moderate complexity patients and allowing them time to try to get set up. And what that brought home to me was a couple of things. First of all, the hospital employees really saw their place as providing healthcare for the community is an important factor in who they were, and they were so interested in trying to be helpful and trying to hang around and trying to do what they could. And the administration was working very hard to try to work out its budget and to try to keep their employees paid through the disaster until they were up and running again. And it was just really a lesson in what can happen all of a sudden. We know that one hurricane you can't necessarily attribute to climate change, but we know that climate change is going to bring more of these severe weather events. And public health people have been looking at this for quite a few years. The Lancet Commission has come out every few years with increasingly dire warnings about the risks of climate-induced disasters. So what are those risks? This is quite a busy slide, and many of you know about a lot of this, but I just want to highlight a couple of things. On the top left, direct heat-related problems. An organization called Climate Central just a few days ago put Las Vegas in first place. We are the number one city in the country for the rate of temperature rise. Our temperature, our average temperature year-round has risen 5.7 degrees Fahrenheit since 1970. Which is stunning. So right here locally, we're already at that 2 degrees centigrade temperature rise that is a precursor to disaster. We know, I work with a low-income population that walks and takes public transportation and works outside and sometimes lives outside, and I know that in your facilities during summer heat waves that you are already seeing direct heat-related illnesses. Air quality is a big concern, and I know that the health district works a lot on that, and a lot of that has to do with carbon fuel pollutants, and there's a tremendous amount of respiratory and cardiovascular disease and cancer diseases that are directly related to climate pollutants. And we're in the middle of a bad allergy season. We have that every year. That's another health impact. Our water quality here is important, and that's a big concern for us here in Southern Nevada going forward. So we are currently and in the future in the direct path of climate impacts. So what does this mean for you as hospital facility people? You know, healthcare systems are going to be challenged to deal with these crisis situations brought about by climate change while trying to navigate the negative business impact like we saw in Panama City, trying to maintain profitability. Those are all challenges that climate change is going to bring directly. And yet at the same time, there are some opportunities. hospitals here are vital resources to the community. They're points of community pride and care. And nationwide, over 10% of the workforce is involved with health care. So hospital systems and health care systems have a strong voice in being supporters or lobbyists for change. And when we look at the opportunity to avoid public health impacts, thinking about climate mitigation, climate adaptation, and sustainability is a great opportunity to make a big difference. So, one of the ways that some health systems have entered that is to be part of the Healthcare Climate Council. This is a coalition of large medical groups, health groups, and organizations around the country that has taken a look at what they can do to take action on the climate. And I'm really pleased that Dignity is part of this group and Cleveland Clinic is part of this group, both of which have a presence in the Valley. They have a few things that they would like to do that they're working on: accelerating investment in renewable energy and efficiency, scaling up health sector adaptation and adoption of resiliency programs and sustainability programs, and advocating for local, state, and national policies to ensure a sustainable and healthy future. So that they joined in 2017 a group of all these health organizations to put together a declaration on climate change and health. And what they said is, as leading public health, patient advocacy, nursing, and medical organizations, we reiterate our longstanding commitment to addressing climate change as a public health issue. They articulate a number of the impacts I just mentioned. They state that the science is clear and already we are experiencing health impacts of climate change. They mentioned that the most vulnerable people in a population, children, the elderly, low-income and communities of color, and people with chronic health conditions are really on the front line for the worst impacts of climate change. They state that bold action is needed and communities need to have tools and resources to adapt to and mitigate the unique impacts of climate change in their communities. They called on Congress and the federal administration to take steps now to reduce pollution and stated that they were united in this effort. So that brings me a little bit to what I'm here for today. So I'm a member of Citizens Climate Lobby. It's an international organization. It's grassroots and volunteer-led. It's bipartisan. We have a chapter here in Las Vegas and about 500 chapters around the country. And our mission is to build the political will for a livable world. And specifically, we're advocating for federal congressional action on climate change. We do support a bill which has been introduced in the House this session. It's called the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. It levies a fee on carbon fuels at the source that goes up gradually, starts low, goes up gradually year by year, and rebates the dividends back to people. Things that I think are pertinent to this group related to that act are that it is estimated that because it puts money in people's pockets, people will actually increase healthcare spending and healthcare jobs are predicted to increase. Overall, 2.1 million total extra jobs are expected in the next 10 years as a result of this legislation. And because air quality is an important issue, it takes a long time of burning less carbon to reduce the temperature rise, but reducing carbon fuel burning has an immediate benefit to air quality. And when you reduce pollution in our polluted valley in the summer, that will have immediate significant health impacts. It's estimated that by 2030, nationwide, about 295,000 additional deaths as a result of air pollution could be avoided by implementing this bill. So I think that's a great thing. So what I'm here today to ask for is perhaps if there's time, maybe to have a longer meeting later with you individually and with your sustainability groups or with your facility committees. We're available for presentations at your hospitals for ground rounds if you're interested. We would love to look at what you're already doing in terms of climate mitigation and sustainability efforts and help to celebrate that and put that
that out on our social media and with our people. And if there are community health outreach events that you would like to have us join with, we'd be very open to doing that. We are looking for support that we can take to our members of Congress because we meet directly with them. And so we're interested in direct support for this bill and for support for congressional action in general regarding climate change. Thanks so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Dr. LaVoie. That was very informative and educational. We appreciate your passion and advocacy. So have you by chance met with Bill Welsh from the Nevada Hospital Association? That may be a good connection.
I've not, but I would love to, okay. I would love to have his contact
with him. We can connect you up.
Okay.
And Dr. Leovi and I have had a couple of discussions about this. There is the Public Health Commission from the Nevada State Medical Association, and we've started discussing that as part of our agendas from NSMA point of view. So you'll be hearing more and more about this. One of the things that you all should be aware of is, why do we have Aedes aegypti? Well, probably here in southern Nevada, we've always been able, because it's warm enough here for the mosquito to overwinter, but it's not warm enough if you go north of our borders until another 5, 10, 15 years. And so that's Zika, that's chikungunya, that's yellow fever, it's dengue fever. That Zika is bad because of the birth defects. But if you've ever seen a patient with dengue or yellow fever, you don't want to. Let me just rephrase that. And those are diseases that the Aedes aegypti mosquito, who is now our neighbor, our permanent neighbor here in southern Nevada, can carry.
Very good. Thank you very much. And we'll send out your contact information. Ms. Maddox will send that out. And we'll also make a connection with you, with Mr. Welch, with the Nevada Hospital, to have that longer meeting.
Beautiful. Okay? Thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am. Okay. Thank you. Okay. Last item under item number five is receive and discuss an update on the integration of the mobile assessment teams for opioid use disorder. Mr. Massman, I think we've had you come up before, sir, right? And this is just an update on all the good work you're doing out in the community. And if you wouldn't mind introducing yourself to the committee and speak loudly in the microphone.
My name is Bryant Massman. I'm with the Center for Behavioral Health.
I'm Christy Smith with the University of Nevada, Reno Public Health.
Very good. It's all yours, sir.
So, thank you for allowing us to come back. This is an update. I don't have slides, but it's an update from a presentation that Christy and Krista gave last January of 2018 on the mobile outreach team, opioid mobile outreach team. Let me just kind of go back, give just a little bit of history of that, so that you understand kind of how this got started. In 2017, the state of Nevada was granted, was given a multi-million dollar grant by SAMHSA, which is the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Association, which is a federal agency, to combat the opioid epidemic. Each state, it was a $500 million bill passed by Congress. Each state received a portion of that in the form of a grant to battle the opioid epidemic in each individual state. The state of Nevada used part of that money to select three organizations within the state of Nevada to act as a hub for the opioid epidemic and to establish spokes into the community to assist in battling the opioid epidemic in northern Nevada as well as southern Nevada. Center for Behavioral Health was chosen as one of the awardees, sub-grant awardees, and in late 2017, we began assembling a team under that grant to do a number of things. The Center for Behavioral Health is an outpatient opioid treatment program and have been here since 1994 in the state of Nevada and the city of Las Vegas. We see probably more opioid addicts per day than anybody else in the city. Currently, we're treating about 1,900 patients a day for opioid addiction. with medication-assisted treatment. As part of the grant, what we were asked to do was to establish a mobile outreach team. And that the goal of that mobile outreach team was to inreach into criminal justice systems as well as hospitals, both in northern Nevada as well as southern Nevada. I think Krista and Christy talked a little bit about that when they were here last January, because that was really the kickoff to begin talking to you folks about the availability of our mobile outreach teams to come to your facilities to provide services to patients who were admitted into either the ER or into the hospital itself for opiate overdose or opiate-related issues. So what we're here today to do is give you just a brief, very brief update. I won't go location by location for all of you. I've got specific notes. If you're interested in where your facility falls in that array, but I can tell you that Christy and Krista have been busy working with your staffs to get our staffs, which are generally made up of, it's usually a peer support specialist who would come to your facility as well as a therapist. And what we found is that different patients obviously relate to different types of people. The patients themselves usually relate very well to a peer support specialist, whereas if we're dealing with families, a lot of times the counselor is the best person to interact with those folks. So we would invite you all to reach out to us as well as we are reaching out to you to assist in providing these services to your patients. Last November 1st, 2018, North Vista Hospital was our first hospital to sign up for the services that we've been delivering to them since that time. It really works, and the beauty of it has been that it's very in the trenches with the patients, and the patients react very well to it. And as a selected what we call hub, as part of a hub and spoke system, we have established relationships with other community treatment providers, other community providers such as housing, bus passes, Medicaid, food stamps, sort of the entire gamut of social services. So if we come to the hospital and we meet with a patient and the patient says, you know what, I'm not interested in treatment, what I'm interested in is a house, we can connect them with that. I'm not interested in treatment, what I'm interested in is food, we can connect them with that. And that's what's been the beauty of the grant money, is it's allowed us to establish those connections in the community through our peer supports, through our counseling staff. We also have a co-occurring counseling staff that is available for the patients to also access, as well as we have four or five physicians that work for us. So we wanted to get ourselves back in front of you and encourage those of you that have not accessed these services to do that. Again, it's at no cost to you. The whole goal is reduced recidivism, right? Reduced return admits. And so we've been very, very successful in treating lots and lots of people, lots of new patients over the course of the last year as a result of the grant, as a result of the mobile outreach team. The mobile outreach team has been utilized more so by the criminal justice system, but I have faith that the hospital systems will continue to improve and increase their access to these services. So, Christy, do you want to add things to that? I know that you've been in and out of every one of these hospitals with Krista. Krista would typically be the person sitting here. She works for me. She's actually made a presentation today just before Donald Trump spoke at the RX and Heroin Summit in Atlanta, Georgia. So, yeah, so very nice to have her there.
Very quickly, the role of the university is we are doing an independent research study on the mobile teams and the effectiveness of it. So we just finished our first year of a pilot. We did feasibility and acceptability. We fed that back to the state, who is overseeing the funding for the teams, tried to help them revamp it, what's going to work better in the future, and we're working very closely with the hospitals to really make it so that it's easy on the hospitals. So in implementation science and 3 years of outcomes is where we're at right now. So really our goal is to get into these complex systems and figure out how is something rolled out that it is not a burden on your staff. So,
and I think that's been the key selling point when we're dealing with staffs, is that we don't want to be in the way, number one. We understand confidentiality, that's number two. We understand our role in this, and in any way we can help, we want to do that. And we don't want to complicate your systems, we want to complement them. And so that's first and foremost, after treating the patient, of course.
Very good. Well, thank you for the update on your progress and all the important work you're doing in the community. We'll make sure we redistribute your contact information.
Please do.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like you've got things up and running at North Vista, so if anybody wants to see how that's integrated into the North Vista team, I'm sure Vince would welcome that and get some feedback. So, but thank you. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Good day. Okay, moving on to item number 6, Dr. Iser, and just looking at the clock, we may start
very quickly.
Okay, yes, thank you, sir.
So just in regards to climate change, one of the things that we're going to be doing is working with the Water District to put solar here. All of our lights are LEDs, and we're looking at putting in solar, partly to decrease the tarmac effect of heat, partly to start to generate renewable energy, and those are kinds of things that you might be interested in as well. One of the bills that I forgot to mention was a maternal mortality review board that we're very supportive of. So any mother who dies at childbirth is a death that could be avoided. And so what we want to do is to support, NSMA is also sponsoring this or is behind this, so that we can start to look at and analyze all of the women who die in and around the time of childbirth. We're getting ready to start our second testing for TB in the school that we have. You probably saw about 6 weeks ago that we had the first round of testing. We're starting the second round now. That'll make some news likely as parents letting the media know. We don't notify the media ourselves. You do know about the level 3 trauma centers who have applied. For influenza, our rates are going down. They've stabilized over the last week, but they're still going down. It's a relatively mild season. We now have started our vector reports. You'll see those, I believe, every Friday on our website. And we test mosquitoes. We do our own testing for those. We smush them up and look for viruses inside the mosquito samples, West Nile virus and so on. So you'll be seeing reports about that. Now that I think John and Jeff are still here, Jeff and I have had discussions about a DMAT team forming down here. Now that we have 2.5 medical schools down south, that ought to be something that we start to look at again. And a DMAT team is a disaster medical assistance team. They're normally sponsored by larger cities with a good group of hospitals and a medical school that can go and respond to emergencies, as Dr. Leovi had described. Florida that you went to, right?
Yes.
Panama City.
Yeah,
so we're looking at maybe seeing how we can help to sponsor that. The final thing is that we have been working for years to get us as a local health authority applicable to apply for CDC grants. Just recently, we got the first one of those where we're applicable. It's called Opioid Data to Action that would provide us, and we've applied for the top of this. I think it's $2.6 to $2.9 million in new funds. The state has $3.5 to $3.9 they can apply for. And so we are applying for those to get a better idea of opioid deaths and mortality and morbidity here. And the final thing related to that is CDC is now going to be opening up an HIV grant that is open to local health authorities and not just states, and we plan to apply for that too. In general, the CDC would say you as a local health authority are or are not eligible to apply. This opioid data to action originally went to other cities, but they had CDC had miscalculated the rates of opioid deaths, and so some of those cities came off the list, and others of us, including us, came on the list. And of course, you would think that it is Southern Nevada, it is Nevada, it is Sin City, that HIV may be high on our list of issues as well. And I think that took 3 minutes, I hope, maybe four.
All good stuff. Thank you, Dr. Iser. Okay, item number seven, facility advisory reports. This is really time set aside for emerging issues or identifying topics for the next meeting. Does anyone have any emerging issues or updates that are on the phone or in the room that would like to be discussed at the next meeting? I think that DMAT team may be very interesting if there's any way that we can help support.
A bit surprised, aren't you?
Yeah. No, use all the help we can during emergencies. So, hearing none, we'll move it to item number eight, public comment. This is time set aside for things that are not on the agenda. Hearing none, seeing none, we'll adjourn. Thank you, everyone. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.